Albert Einstein worked to unlock mysteries of time and space, but his son set his sights closer to home. Hans Albert Einstein worked to unravel the complexities of rivers. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with the authors of Hans Albert Einstein, his life as a pioneering engineer. They are Cornelia Mutel of the University of Iowa and Robert Etema of the University of Wyoming. We'll talk about Einstein's early life, his relationship with his world-famous father, and his own path as a scientist. We'll also talk about the important work he did in understanding the complex interaction of flowing water and sediment. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Hans Albert Einstein was the oldest son of Albert Einstein and a great scientist in his own right. This hour, I'll talk with the authors of Hans Albert Einstein, his life as a pioneering engineer. Robert Etema will join us in a little while. He's a professor of engineering at the University of Wyoming. But with me in the studio right now is Connie Mutel. She is a senior science writer at IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. Hello, Connie.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And Robert is on the line with us now. Hello, Rob.
Hello. Good morning, Charity. Good morning, Connie.
Thank you for being here today. And I want to, before we dive into the story of Hans Albert Einstein, I want to get a little bit of your stories, because the story of this book actually goes back about 25 years to 1990. Connie, tell me how this story, how this man really first came to your attention.
Well, that is a story in itself. I came to the hydraulics lab in 1990 to work on the project about Hans Albert Einstein. And at that time, Jack Kennedy, Professor John F. Kennedy, who went by Jack Kennedy, was the director there and was writing about various hydraulicians and trying to put together a fairly complete history of different people working in hydraulics. And he had worked some on Hans Albert Einstein, contacted Hans Albert's widow, Elizabeth, who was still living in Berkeley, getting to be quite old. And she said, well, I have written a book about my husband, my dear husband. Would you publish it for me? And Jack Kennedy, just on the spur of the moment, said, I think he said on the spur of the moment, of course, we'd love to do that for you. And then got the manuscript and realized that it would be a difficult project. So he hired me to take over that project. And then I went ahead to collect materials to straighten out some of the facts in Elizabeth's book. And in doing so, kind of hit a treasure trove of Einstein family materials, and the project took off from there.
And you were originally going to write this book in conjunction with Jack Kennedy. The two of you were going to work together on it?
We were, and we started to work on it. Tragically, Jack died about two years after I came to the hydraulics lab, and it was he was a young man at the time, fairly young. So that was very difficult. Rob then took over Jack's role, became acting director for several years, and stepped in as Jack's replacement on the book. And we've been working together ever since.
Well, and Rob, tell me about when you first got involved with this subject matter. What was it that told you that this was a project that you really needed to pursue?
Well, I'd always known of Hans Albert Einstein through his work and my work in the same area, and I'd known early on from when Connie joined the lab at the University of Iowa, and from Jack that the project was underway, and so when Jack unfortunately passed on, Connie was there with all the work that she had done and all this material at hand. And it seemed that this project should continue. So I rather naively volunteered to step in and help.
And this rather naively, since that was 20 years ago or so, stepped in to work on this project. But you actually were pretty close to being done with this project for a very long time, right, Connie?
Well, I think we were, yeah. I think both of us did get into it without realizing what a big job it would be. But one of the things that we were given early on by Elizabeth Einstein was a collection of letters that another family member had put together between Albert and Mileva, Albert's first wife. And that revealed a great deal about their relationship and the early Einstein family interactions, including Hans Albert's youth. And so, of course, we wanted to use that. But we were told that we wouldn't be able to publish that information because there's a very well-established collected papers of Albert Einstein project going on here in the U.S., also some work going on at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And frankly, the people didn't want someone else to publish that information before they put it into their collected volumes. So we kind of sat that out, waited for certain family members to mellow or to go to other lands. And then the project opened up quite a bit in recent years.
So, I mean, of course, Albert Einstein is a man that everyone knows a little something about, and he is a man that there's this tremendous amount of mythology that surrounds his life and his work. So is that sort of what you were stepping into? You were trying to write a book about his son, but is it a little bit of a minefield to tread there?
Very much. There are numerous family members who own different pieces of information. It's complicated legally, and I've worked with many university lawyers on this project. But it's hard. There's an agency in California that owns rights to his picture. The Hebrew University owns the copyright, but they've given some of it to Princeton University Press, and just figuring out who has what rights and getting the proper permissions is very difficult. And also, I think some of the stories about Albert, which have come out in recent years, when we started working on the project, those stories had not been revealed. So we had to wait till someone else opened them up.
And Rob, you said, well, of course, I've always known of the work of Hans Albert Einstein. And for a lot of people, today is the first day they're hearing his name. Can you give me an idea of really his standing in your field?
Yes, he's regarded as one of the top figures in this field of civil engineering hydraulics, that's water engineering, and in particular, the way that flowing water in rivers conveys sediment, alluvial sediment, sand and gravel and clays, for instance. And he did some very pioneering work in this area. So for me, the name Einstein and the pedigree create an opportunity, in a way, a very useful vehicle for telling, I think, an important story about how engineers and scientists in this country and around the world, really, got to better understand how rivers like the Missouri River or the Iowa River transport sediment and how important sediment is in various ways for how we live on this planet.
And we are going to dig into some of that research and some of the discoveries that Hans Albert Einstein made as the hour goes on, in conjunction with releasing this book and the culmination of this 25 years of work on both of your parts. There are a number of events happening this week. You will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore on Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. On Thursday, there is a seminar or presentation, Hans Albert Einstein, Albert's son and pioneering engineer, that you'll be presenting at the College of Engineering. And that is open to the public as well, right, on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And then on Friday, you mentioned Jack Kennedy, Connie. On Friday, you're taking a moment to really honor his work as well.
Right. And this is something we wanted to do. This is probably the last major project that Jack Kennedy started. I don't know if that's true, but he was a wonderful person in his own right, and we want to just appreciate, take a minute to step back and honor his contribution to history in general, history of hydraulics, and to this project. So we'll be giving a seminar. Rob will be giving a seminar on John Fisher Kennedy, student and statesman of water engineering, Friday afternoon at 1:30, and that's at the hydraulics lab at the corner of Riverside and Burlington Road, Burlington
right.
Street, yeah.
Okay, and now I want to take the plunge into the personal story of Hans Albert Einstein. And Connie, I know that this was really your focus in doing this research. And as I mentioned, there's so much mythology around Albert Einstein. So we'll get to the real story right now. And let's talk about the first marriage of Albert Einstein and his first wife, Mileva. When did they meet?
They met when they were both college students in Zurich, Switzerland, and became intimate with one another and in many ways, including intellectually, and would sit and talk. People now say that they would sit and talk and do their calculations together were a very close couple. They actually had one child before they were married, who has disappeared, and scholars have tried to find her and haven't been able to do so.
And they had a child before they were married, partially because Mileva's family was really opposed to the marriage?
Well, I think that if you look at the letters, it's mostly financial. You know, people didn't used to get married until they could have a financially stable family. And it was more Albert Einstein's family that was adamantly opposed to the relationship. When they did get married, people now say that at least at the beginning of the relationship, Albert and Mileva did their calculations together, and that she may have made some contributions to his development of the theory of special relativity, which was first published in 1905. We'll never know if that's true or not. But in any case, they were a close couple, and I think that relationship started to disintegrate when Albert started to gain in fame, which happened very, very, very rapidly between Hans Albert's birth in 1904 and the dissolution of the marriage in 1914. By that time, Albert Einstein had been a faculty member in several locations in Europe, and in Berlin was about to become the head of a major physics institute, and they didn't make it there together.
we're gonna take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more. This hour, I'm talking with the authors of the new book, Hans Albert Einstein, His Life as a Pioneering Engineer, Connie Mutel with the University of Iowa and Rob Etema of the University of Wyoming. They will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Hans Albert Einstein. He's the oldest son, was the oldest son of Albert Einstein, and a great scientist in his own right. I'm talking with the authors of a new book, Hans Albert Einstein, His Life as a Pioneering Engineer. Connie Mutel is here with me. She is senior science writer at IIHR, Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. Rob Etema is also here. He's a professor of engineering at the University of Wyoming, and the two of them have been working on this book together for a very long time. We're going to, in a little while, dig into the work of Hans Albert Einstein and talk about the discoveries that he made and how we still use the information that he discovered today. And right now, though, we're focusing on the personal story, which, Connie, was your part of writing this book. And as I mentioned, Hans Albert was the oldest child of Albert Einstein, a product of his first marriage to a woman named Mileva. And Hans Albert was born in 1904. 1905 is considered to be Albert Einstein's miracle year. And from what you could find, Connie, what was life like in the Einstein home when Albert Einstein was coming up with all of these amazing discoveries and publishing all of these papers and really starting to become a very, very famous man? And there was a toddler there learning to walk, Mileva, who had been a scholar herself at home caring for a child. What do we know about that life?
Well, and let me say that one of the thrills of writing this book was figuring out questions like that. And we did have access to letters. Of course, Albert and Mileva they were living together, so they didn't write to each other. But they both wrote letters to friends, and we had access to those. So those letters reflected a really happy time, I think, for the whole family. Good sentiments. It seemed like the parents appreciated each other. And Albert, again, was not well-known at all then. He wasn't for at least 5 or 6 years. He didn't start teaching until about 6 years later. But so I think that Albert was quite involved with his son. There are stories about him bouncing Hans Albert on his knee or playing the violin for the baby to quiet him in this very small apartment that they lived in Bern, Switzerland. And I do think that in later years, Hans Albert told about the many ways that his father shaped him, giving him math problems, taking him out in nature, teaching him to observe natural phenomena, to watch the flow of rivers. Albert definitely loved his children. He had a second son, Edward, born in 1910, and did his best to influence them in the way that he thought was appropriate.
And you mentioned as he became a faculty member at different institutions, he needed to move around. The family did not move around as much. And at a certain point, they just wound up in different places.
Well, they did. The family, entire family did move first to Zurich, then to Prague and back to Zurich and eventually to Berlin. But if you look at the letters then from Mileva to friends, the letters reflect that that she felt increasingly isolated from her husband, and that her husband had less and less time for the children. And eventually in Berlin, Albert by that time was intimate with his cousin, Elsa, whom he later married. And that was quite obvious to everybody in the family. And Mileva went there for about 2 months and then took the train back. I think that was the day before the outbreak of World War I. She took the train back to Zurich, and that was the separation that later became a divorce.
And I was just going to say, all of this was playing out at a very turbulent time in world history.
Turbulent in world history and extremely turbulent for Hans Albert, who was 10 and from early on was described as the family's little man. It's amazing when you think by the time he was 12, his mother was in and out of sanatoriums, and he was doing some of the negotiations to get her to the hospital. His father and his little brother soon became ill. They had food shortages. They needed more money from Albert. Hans Albert actually would write his father budgets and say, we need money for this and that. And Albert would write back and say, that's too much. You have to live more cheaply. And there were times that were very, very difficult. And during those periods, I think Hans Albert developed a lot of animosity toward his father that came out really until the two of them were both getting to be in their later years.
And they had a correspondence with each other. And Albert Einstein tried very hard to, it sounds like, keep that correspondence separate from his very strained relationship with his ex-wife.
Right, yeah. He wrote directions to Mileva about what she could do about the letters. She could read some of them. She couldn't read them all. She couldn't influence the children. He wanted to maintain very, very deeply the communications with his children, but he also and he would propose things like, let's get together for vacation. Why don't you come and live with me in Germany? But when the push came to shove, he didn't follow through oftentimes. So I think there was some double messages going on there as well.
It strikes me as remarkable that through all of this, Hans Albert Einstein was an excellent student. I mean, this sounds like a recipe for disaster for an adolescent who is really taking care of his mother and his brother. But he did pursue his studies and clearly demonstrated a very fine mind.
Yes, he did. And I think that one of the miracles of his life is that he developed, despite all of the difficulties, and they were physical as well as carrying the Einstein name, having his professors expect too much of him, but also just the problems with World War I, the onset of the troubles that led to World War II, when his father kind of really went to extraordinary means to get him out of Europe, all sorts of things that could have been led to somebody crashing. In spite of all of those things, Hans Albert became a very fine scientist who contributed quite a bit to the field that he was in, and also was a very, very decent and good man to interact with as a student.
The description of how much trouble Albert Einstein and Mileva had getting married and all the family standing in the way, it comes back as quite ironic when Hans Albert wants to get married, because he falls in love with a woman, an older woman, actually, and both of his parents disapprove.
Right, yeah. And there were a number of parallels between the father and the son. Both of them were married twice. The temperaments of the first wives were similar. The temperaments of the second wives were similar. A lot of uncanny parallels there. But Albert clearly had a message that he wanted to give to his son, and he wasn't soft-spoken in giving his messages at all.
It was quite vitriolic in saying,
at times,
do not marry
Frida,
his first wife.
Yeah.
And he was concerned because she had a history of mental illness in her family.
Well, he thought that. Okay. I don't know that she ever really did. But, of course, the irony there was that
Hans Albert did have a history of mental illness in his family.
Albert did.
Right.
Yeah,
Hans Albert's family
was very, very healthy. But
Edward,
Albert, the second son, was mentally ill for most of his life and had led a very tragic life.
And was actually diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Correct.
So that's Hans Albert's brother.
Yeah, right.
But he does marry Frida.
He does, and they have a very loving, good relationship and have a family. Had actually three sons, two of whom died, adopted a daughter, and had a good, happy life, I think.
Well, and Rob, I want to bring you back into the conversation at this point, and maybe both of you can shed some light on this. This hour I'm talking with the authors of the new book, Hans Albert Einstein, His Life as a Pioneering Engineer. But Rob, Connie was mentioning that when Hans Albert was a young man, he was very connected with nature and the natural world. He liked to spend time outside. When did he start to study rivers, and how did that come about?
Well, I think he, as you say, he'd had from young of age, he had an interest in water and observing water, as indeed many people do. And that's partly what makes this topic in this book so fascinating, too. Well, I think for one reason and another, his father drew him back from Germany to Switzerland in about 1931, just as the Nazis were rising in power in Germany, and it was not a safe place to be as a relative of Albert Einstein. And it so happened that there was a major new project underway at a very new hydraulics laboratory at the Swiss Technical University, ETH, in Zurich. And through Mileva and Albert, an opening was spotted for Hans Albert as a graduate student working with the lead professor there in the hydraulic and the water engineering area, Professor Maya Peter. And he had an interesting project and problem to solve, and that was the Alpine Rhine, the length of the Rhine from Lake Constance into the Alps. Needed adjustment, and because it was threatening to flood, and what made this project a little bit sort of tense in a way was that the river, as many rivers do, formed the border between Switzerland and Austria and also Liechtenstein. And this was in a period in the 30s where tensions were a bit raw anyway.
Right.
So it was a very important project, a very important opportunity for Hans Albert. And Albert facilitated Hans Albert's move to ETH and to this position as a graduate student of Meyer Peter. And I might add, too, that Albert had passing interest in rivers and how they flow and had written one or two papers about this topic. Anyway,
So from your perspective, Rob, was this a field of study that Hans Albert was sort of naturally drawn to, or was this serendipity that he wound up in a field that he also cared about?
I think it was an element of serendipity, I think. He was working as a structural engineer in Germany on various projects, some to do with rivers, but more from a structural aspect, bridges and so forth. And so when this opportunity arose, I think it took him a little while to really grasp it. He was kind of a diffident student to begin with, but he seemed to have gotten the bug pretty quickly and realized that he was standing at a point, a rather momentous point, where there was great need for knowledge in how rivers flow and how they move sediment. And I think Meyer Peter may have expected good things from Hans Albert. Indeed, and eventually Hans Albert, who was a talented fellow, produced some very interesting insights. And so by the time he'd finished his graduate studies at ETH in Zurich, I would say he was probably the most knowledgeable fellow on the planet in terms of how water moves sediment along a riverbed.
Wow. And Connie, you mentioned his troubled relationship with his father. After he graduated, his first job, he was very proud of the fact that he got it on his own without his father's assistance after this field of study, or was that before?
That was before. That was when he came out of ETH as an undergraduate in 19. He was 22 then.
So at this point, with his father's assistance, did he have problems with the fact that his father was helping him, assisting in his career at all?
No, I don't think so. I think he probably sensed too that Germany was increasingly a difficult place to be. And once he saw the unique opportunity he had in working with Professor Meyer Peter in Zurich on the Alpine Rhine, I think he really, in a way, took off. He really became a lead assistant, in a way, for Professor Meyer Peter and contributed some very useful insights.
Now, you mentioned, again, this was a very difficult time politically in the world, particularly in the part of the world they were living in. And Albert Einstein makes the move to the United States not long after Hans Albert and his family make the move to the United States. How did that come about? And either one of you, Connie, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. That did come about through Albert's influence. Albert got convinced Hans Albert to come for a visit. He then set up interviews around the country, paid for his son to go and visit places from California to Washington, D.C. And when Hans Albert returned, Albert then continued the negotiations. So he was a very good asset to have as a father at that point.
Absolutely. And so he came to the United States and he went to South Carolina. Rob, what was his focus there?
Well, I think I think the hope was that Hans Albert would end up working with Theodore von Karman out in California in Caltech. Von Karman was a leading aeronautical professor, or scientist, engineer, and very well regarded in flume mechanics. But that didn't quite work out. But still, with von Karman's help and Albert's help, Hans Albert got a position with the newly formed Soil Conservation Service. And recall that in the 1930s, the Dust Bowl years, rising concerns about sediment and rivers, new dams that were looking to fill up with sediment quicker than what people had expected or realized, erosion concerns on farm fields and so forth. So the whole broad area of sediment really rose to the fore in the 30s. And so this agency, the SES, the Soil Conservation Service, was looking for talent. And here comes Hans Albert with, in a way, unique and leading insight from Europe and good background from a good European program. So he, in a way, is grabbed by the Soil Conservation Service, and they he's not a U.S. citizen, so it's difficult to give him a formal job, a federal job right away, but he ends up working with the SES's very new field laboratory in Greenville, South Carolina. So you can imagine quite a cultural contrast from Zurich to Greenville, Carolina in 1937.
Certainly. And this was also a difficult time personally for Hans Albert and his first wife, Frieda, because they lost their oldest child and then had a baby who died as an infant, right?
Correct. Yeah, actually lost the second son and then an infant as well.
Oh, wow. We're going to take a short break. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with the authors of the new book, Hans Albert Einstein, His Life as a Pioneering Engineer. We're talking about his personal story and also his very significant contributions to hydroscience, our understanding of how water and sediment move in rivers. The authors will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. in Iowa City. Also, they'll be doing a seminar Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m. at the College of Engineering. That seminar is also open to the public. I'm talking with Rob Edema and Connie Mutel, again, the authors of Hans Albert Einstein, His Life as a Pioneering Engineer. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with the authors of the new book, Hans Albert Einstein, His Life as a Pioneering Engineer. This book has been 25 years in the making. And with me, Connie Mutel. She's senior science writer at IIHR, Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. And Robert Edema. He's a professor of engineering at the University of Wyoming. Spent some time also at the University of Iowa when they started working on this book together about 20-some years ago. So this is a project that has been a very long time in coming. And Rob, before the break, we were talking about the work that Hans Albert Einstein was doing in South Carolina when he came to the United States in studying rivers and the way that sediment interacted in that system, in our river systems. And, you know, it strikes me that these are conversations that we are continuing to have today. We have these conversations in Iowa all the time about the amount of soil lost in our waterways. And, of course, as that water moves down, for example, the Mississippi River, the different ways that the sediment interacts and also the pollutants. But back in 1935, 36, what was our understanding of sediment moving in rivers? What did we know?
Well, we knew relatively little, really, and there were two basic questions which were very important for a whole host of reasons, much to do with infrastructure and building of bridges and so forth and prevention of flooding. One question was, first of all, what's the relationship between water flow in a river and how much sediment that river conveys? And then, relatedly, how does that water convey the sediment? The other big question was, what's the relationship between water discharge and water depth in a river? And keep in mind that the river, you can imagine, as having almost two free surfaces, the air-water interface at the top, which can go up and down, and the sediment-water interface at the bottom, which also can go up and down. Riverbeds move, erode, silt up, and so forth. And so these are two very basic questions that were very much on the mind of engineers. And so in the 1930s, engineers had very, very rudimentary ways of addressing these two questions. And certainly the ways that were available then were very approximate, were not very scientifically or physics-based. And that's where Hans Albert steps into the picture. He takes a very mechanical look at how rivers work, how water moves, how sediment moves in rivers, and proceeds to develop two relationships by and large, water and sediment, water flow and water depth, which eventually become leading relationships for engineers to use in this country and abroad.
So he was building models to be able to observe how sediment would move in the water, or what was he doing?
He was in Switzerland. He had a large lab channel or flume where he could observe and really look very closely how sediment moved in water. In South Carolina, they built a big outdoor channel which captured part of the river there, the NRA River, and tried to relate its flow of water and how it moves sediment. But the trouble with big field stations is they don't get enough data. They rely on storms and so forth, and they're not always that frequent. And so he scaled the whole thing down and developed a small mobile field measurement facility, which you could take around on the back of a truck, and measured sediment movement and water flow in small streams around South Carolina and Mississippi. And so mainly from field observations and then from his own theory and ideas on how water moves sediment. He was fairly focused and in some ways fairly stubborn about how things should proceed in the formulation, and he stuck through this formulation process through much of his career, perfecting it and tuning it, and such that in about a decade or so later, he developed and had published by the Department of Agriculture the leading formulation or method for engineers and scientists to use in determining how a river like the Iowa River or the Missouri River, for instance, or the Arkansas River, how much sediment those rivers convey as flow in those rivers change.
The point at which he was doing this research was a period of there were a lot of things going on, obviously, with world wars, but also the Great Depression. You mentioned the Dust Bowl. It was a period also of kind of an intense environmental crisis in the United States. The forests in the Midwest, in Michigan and Minnesota and Wisconsin, had basically been clear cut. We had altered the landscape to the point where there were a lot of bad things happening, a lot of wildfires. Was there a similar crisis in how we had been managing our waterways as well?
Yes, I think certainly the symptoms of the crisis became very clear in the 1930s with the Dust Bowl and with new reservoirs starting to silt up and soil erosion and land losing its fertility, loss of soil and so on. And a lot of those issues got set aside in the early 40s because of World War II. But those issues came back with a vengeance right after World War II. And so, for instance, in 1947, all the federal agencies realized that the major problem that they had to deal with met at the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's facility in Denver, Colorado, and to talk about sediment issues, erosion, sediment transport in rivers, siltation of reservoirs. And in 1947 at this particular conference, that's when Hans Albert was really recognized for the first time in the U.S. He was seen as perhaps one of few leading experts in this area. And so quickly from 1947, he gets a academic position as a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. And there he goes on to be center stage in terms of rivers, flows, sediment transport in the U.S., and also consulting abroad.
So he became extremely prominent in this field. And Connie, I want to go back to you because, again, in contrast to his father, who sort of developed a cult of personality around himself, and he spent many, many, many hours with his students. They would work, and then they would go out together, and then they would go back to Albert Einstein's home and talk until the early morning hours and that kind of thing. Hans Albert was a little more standoffish with his students.
And my impression is that Albert had that intense relationship with his students when he was younger. By the time he got to Germany and then to Princeton, I don't know if that happened anymore. I don't think that he was acting as a professor. He was more doing research. Hans Albert was a very good mentor. He obviously loved being a professor. He loved lecturing. He loved doing the research. He loved interacting with the students. But the students would say that he was a very good friend, but never a close friend. He had very, very rigid boundaries about things that he would discuss with them, and those would never extend at all into the personal, which was could have been standard for professors at the time, but it was probably accentuated by his feeling that people were trying to kind of get information. He had always felt people tried to get information about Albert through him, and I think that was something that he resented.
And Rob, you mentioned how respected he was in his field. As far as actual practical applications of the research he was doing, I mean, we continue to struggle with these problems today with our rivers and streams. Did he ever get frustrated that he had reached this point of understanding, he'd reached this level of professional success, but people were still making some of the same mistakes that we've been making for centuries when it comes to managing waterways?
Well, one of the challenges, and I'd say one of the wonderful things about rivers, is they're so complex. And so there's lifetimes of research and investigation and science and engineering to be done. And so he was in a very good position to be a consultant for many agencies in this country, particularly the Army Corps of Engineers, and with whom he worked extensively along the Missouri River, helping with the implementation of the large Pick Sloan plan, which intended to put about five more dams on the main stem of the Missouri River, and in parallel along the Arkansas River. Also putting in dams, increasing navigation along the river, and his ideas were very good in terms of understanding the physics of flow and sediment movement. The challenge for engineers is translating those physics into reliable design relationships, and to a certain extent there was success, but then the heavy hand of complexity of nature quickly comes into the game, and these design relationships work somewhat, but are not perfect, and need further work and investigation.
Well, and even if the design relationships are understood, I mean, there are still a lot of things standing in the way of implementation. I mean, obviously money, but also just how we as a society interact with our waterways.
Well, that's right, and we have big plans, noble plans such as Pick Sloan to work with the water along the Missouri system, but we quickly come to realize that nature can be very complicated and very, very complex and in its behavior, and that behavior is not easy to cast in reliable design relationships for engineering projects. And so there's ongoing work, adjusting projects, improving things, getting better insights into things. And this whole facet, in a way, leads also to another theme in the book, which is to do with the different points of view about how to understand a river. Among engineers, particularly Hans Albert and others, the thing was to take a good physics approach, mechanical approach to how water and sediment moves in rivers, and from that get more reliable design relationships. But there are other engineers and scientists who would simply say that, well, rivers are just far too complicated to form in nice, tidy physics relationships. We have to learn from what we observe and empirically get a sense of how the character of a river is or a part of a river is, and from that get a sense of the proportions that we need for designing channels and so forth. This latter approach doesn't really get under the skin in terms of physics of how things behave, so you can see that naturally enough debates arise between engineers and scientists, among scientists themselves, about how best to approach something as complex as an alluvial river in terms of understanding how it works and designing structures like bridges and dams and so forth along it, or navigation pathways along them.
Rob, I mentioned earlier in the hour how you and Connie have been working on this project for a very, very long time. And I can imagine that many people would have gotten frustrated and given up on this project, having worked on it for that long a period of time. Why was it so important to you to continue on and to tell this story and get this published?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, it's a story that needs to be told, I think, about how engineers and scientists really, over the period of the 30s through the 70s, even still continuing today, really, came to understand more about how rivers flowed, how they conveyed sediment, and how we could translate some of the physics into better design relationships, not perfect design relationships by any means, but more reliable ones that we could use in designing navigation paths along rivers, dams, bridge sites, water intakes, all the things that go in terms of our infrastructure related to rivers. And on a second level, perhaps, I've enjoyed working with Connie. Connie's a first-class writer, and it's made the project very enjoyable.
And let me say, we've enjoyed working together. It goes both ways.
Well, and Connie, why was it important for you to tell this story?
I feel it was part of my professional dedication, both to the hydraulics lab and to the project itself. We had information that no one would again have. And if we didn't tell this story, it would never be told, because many of the people that we interviewed are now dead. Many of the resources that we were able to use are now scattered. It was now or never, and I agree with Rob. It's a story that should have been told, and we wanted to do it, so we finished it.
With many famous families, there can be almost a level of pressure that comes to bear because of carrying a family name, and I can imagine that the name Einstein brings with it a kind of pressure that almost no other name can bring. But at the same time, the name Einstein is going to bring attention to this story that wouldn't have been there.
Well, I think that was the hope, that we could use this interesting story in itself. Hans Albert was an interesting person in his own right, even if he didn't have that name. But the name adds interest, it adds another layer, and it's a way of hopefully drawing people into understanding some of the science.
And Rob, it's going to take a lot of doing, but when people hear the name Hans Albert Einstein, obviously you don't want them to first think about his very famous father, but when they hear his name, what is the one thing you want people to know about this man?
Well, he made important contributions to two very fundamental questions with regard to rivers at an important time in the history of this country. And the questions, again, were the relationship between water flow in a river and how much sediment the river conveys. And then the other question is the relationship between water flow and say, the depth and cross-section of the channel. And these are very important, as you can imagine, very important engineering questions that pop up often with the design of various things along rivers.
And science we are still depending on today.
Absolutely.
Rob Edema, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Connie Mutel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
I've been talking this hour with Rob Edema and Connie Mutel, the authors of Hans Albert Einstein, His Life as a Pioneering Engineer. They'll be reading Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. And with me in the studio now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. What's coming up at noon today?
Hi, Charity. We're going to be talking about binge drinking, heavy drinking. Iowa ranked one of the highest binge drinking states in the country. So we're going to talk about prevention today and what's really at the heart of heavy drinking and binge drinking culture on campuses and in our communities.
All right, coming up at noon today on River to River. And tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, I will be talking with Half Pint herself, the actress Melissa Gilbert. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.